I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Want to welcome our listeners to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about an issue that is in the news. Boy, is it ever in the news. An issue of great contemporary significance that I think helps us, though, to understand more deeply some fundamental American principles at the heart of our American founding and of our U.S. Constitution. The topic today is government censorship of social media. And I'm joined for the conversation today by John Vecchione. John is the senior litigation counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, specializing in strategic litigation in the federal district and appellate courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. John is a member of the bar of the state of New York, of Washington, D.C., and the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we have with us today a person who really knows the legal issues, who has been actively involved in litigating the issues, and is working for an organization that is profoundly dedicated to these issues. John, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you very much. And I think also I'm counsel of record for the individuals in the Murphy v. Missouri case.
So, and yes, importantly, so involved in litigation sort of as we are speaking, very important. John, for a lot of our listeners, of course, as you know, are historically informed folks who care about American history and principles, but they're not litigators like you. They didn't go to law school. They don't necessarily know the state of the law and of the Constitution on issues like freedom of speech and freedom of press, which are connected to social media. Take a step back to get us started. The broad principles of freedom of speech and free press, where do we stand with regard to the law on those issues?
The law on those issues is very well developed for newspapers and for books and for speech and even for television, things like that. And you have a very broad area of free speech, particularly under the current Supreme Court. They've even found that people protesting at funerals or people saying that they were in a war and won all these medals when they didn't win them is free speech. So it's very broad on that score. But where it is not well developed, because the First Amendment only protects you against government censorship, is the question of the internet and social media. Who's speaking? Whose speech is being violated? Are private entities doing it? Or is this the government doing it? Or is it both in some kind of mixture? And if it is a mixture, what do we do about that? These questions are all up in the air. And the final question is also, what if the state has regulatory power in an area and says it's using it for one reason, but is really using it to silence speech?
Well, let's start with that idea of government censorship. Clearly, it can take at least a couple of forms. One is direct government censorship, things like prior restraint, so prohibiting someone from publishing before it even goes out. And then the more well-known form of censorship is once it's published or spoken, then it's punished. But you are not talking simply about that kind of direct government censorship. You're talking about perhaps a more indirect way that government censors. Tell us about that.
So there are three cases for the Supreme Court right now, all of which involve one is the net choice cases. There's two of them against Texas and Florida, where basically Texas and Florida, there's differences in the statutes, but it's basically they didn't want the private entities discriminating against certain views on their social media. And so they put these laws in, and NetChoice and the social media said, no, you can't put those laws in because we have editorial power to, you know, we're private entities and we can put who we want on our platform. So that's one group, and I'm not involved in those cases, but it is an actual law that was passed that the challengers say is impeding their right to edit and say what they want and not allow other people to speak. Then there's our case, Murthy v. Missouri, where the states of Missouri and Louisiana, as well as my clients, who are four individual clients, all of whom were censored on social media, not because the social media wanted to do it, but the government leaned on them, and I'll get into that in a minute. And then also one other group, not one other individual, not in represented by us, Jim Hoft of Gateway Pundit, was also severely basically taken down from social media because the government didn't like what he was saying. And then the final case, which is another way of doing this, because what you're going to find is in Murthy, they were leaning on these companies in a number of ways and threatening them with antitrust, with Section 230, which gives them a lot of protections so that stuff on their platform they don't get sued for, that we're going to interpret that differently, okay, or we're going to get rid of it. These were threats used against social media if they didn't take down messages. So then the final one is the Vulo case versus the New York banking regulatory authorities, where there they didn't like the message of the NRA. And that's an interesting case because the ACLU is defending the NRA in that case. And there, all they said is we regulate banks and we tell banks that certain businesses that you're involved in could give you reputational risk. Your bank could be have its reputation injured and then people would draw money out and it would hurt your bank. They said that that was the case with the NRA and tried to get it debanked in New York. And they said this is part of our regulatory power. But the evidence is very clear. They did it for one reason. They didn't like the NRA's messages. So we have three different categories of doing it. In Murthy is the one where the government said it wasn't doing anything, that it was just advising these social media companies. It was just sometimes it's called jawbone. It was just telling them the government's view. It was exercising the government's ability to speak. And we obviously disagree with that. But so you've basically got three different ways where the government can get involved with your speech.
So let's talk about your particular case. You said the government leaned on private companies, social media companies. Tell us about the facts of the case for our listeners who may not know them.
All right. So in Murthy v. Missouri, as I said, there's two states and five individuals suing the federal government. And what happened is in various areas, our clients were mainly concerned with vaccine issues and COVID issues and COVID lockdown issues. Martin Koldorf and Jay Bhattacharya and Aaron Carity were all more of a scientific bent on the vaccines are this valuable or not this valuable, masking's this valuable or not this valuable. Here's our approach to the virus, what it should be. And then Jill Hines, she runs a, I'd say, a more political outfit in Louisiana about health freedom, meaning you shouldn't be required to take any vaccines. That should be a personal choice issue, I think is the best way to put it. And she would try to get that message out to politics in Louisiana. And for my clients, all of these messages were downgraded without my clients knowing why. Because they weren't violating the terms of service of Twitter or Facebook or any of them. And what we found down, we filed this down in Louisiana, and for the Missouri and the states, they wanted to hear what their constituents thought about the Hunter Biden laptop corruption issue, and also voting, whether or not there was voting skullduggery going on. And all these messages had been downplayed as well. And all the government said was, hey, not us. The federal government says not us. But then we got discovery. And these are where the facts come in. What we found is that the social media had given a portal, special portals to the government to say what messages they didn't like. And they didn't say, oh, put our message up next to those messages so that we can get our message out or help us to get our message out. There was some evidence. I deposed the head of social media at the CDC, and they had gotten this idea from the census. The census apparently had been worried about misstatements about the census, and they just ask the Twitter and Facebook and social media guys, hey, when people see these messages that people are going to get arrested if we come to the census or anything like that, how do we get our message out that that's not going to happen? And that appears to be all that happened. But then the CDC gets hold of it and says, well, how do we downgrade these other messages? How do we silence them? And the same with the FBI. The FBI went in and said, you know, that watch out, there's going to be a lot of Russian disinformation. And then when the Hunter laptop came out, they didn't tell them that it wasn't Russian disinformation. And so what you had was a huge government effort to keep some messages off. And the White House got involved. It started under the Trump administration with the CDC saying these messages are no good. We'd like you to get rid of them, that sort of thing. But then the White House got involved with the Biden administration, and they're calling these people, not once, not twice, not like a, hey, here's a word to the wise, constant harassment. And then the Jen Psaki from the White House is saying about how there's antitrust things they can do and how Section 230 needs to be looked at and there has to be consequences. And you see a lot of emails and a lot of statements by the White House that there's got to be consequences against the social media companies because messages that the Biden White House didn't like were coming out. And that threat, that perceived threat, one of the Fifth Circuit judges said, well, it's kind of like, nice social media company you got there. Shame if anything would happen to it. So the lower court judge—
but almost like a mafia boss.
That is correct. That was the implication. And so the lower court enjoined this. They said, listen, you cannot, there's all exceptions, unlawful speech, right? Child abuse, recruiting terrorists. You know, there's unlawful speech even in this country. There are things you just can't do. Can't defraud anyone. You can't lie and sell something on the internet or you can get charged, right? So all that speech is protected if the government wants to say, look, we think that this, you know, what you have here is a criminal enterprise and these are criminal acts and here's the criminal acts that have been committed. That's one thing. But for core protected speech, they are not allowed to influence, talk to, or urge these social media companies or threaten them to take it down. That's what the injunction said. The injunction was changed a little bit by the Fifth Circuit, which was the appellate circuit to Louisiana. And then it was stayed by the Supreme Court with three dissents. So it's stayed right now, but the court, we had arguments and we told the court what the facts were. And we have, I like to show this to the extent your viewers can see it. This is just a little bit of the facts that we put before the Supreme Court. This big old
for our listeners, it looks like hundreds of pages.
Oh yeah, it's huge with how many emails and threats and various things that we're doing, and then plus the affidavits of our clients of how they got thrown off of social media, not knowing why it was. So you have this very insidious governmental effort to take down these messages. And what I always emphasize to every audience is, my clients, particularly Jay Bhattacharya, and Martin Kulldorff, he was one of the most cited epidemiologists in the world before COVID. And then Fauci calls them, you know, outlier scientists. And suddenly they come under scrutiny for true things they were saying, things that right now the CDC agrees with, that the vaccines are best taken by older people and younger people may not need them at all. The fact that masks don't work to stop the spread, the fact that vaccines do not, that the most of the vaccines do not stop the spread of COVID. All these things were taken off social media and all of them were true. And so they always say misinformation, misinformation. The chief misinformer in these aspects was the federal government. And they were the ones able to throw you off social media. It's kind of outrageous.
Let's talk a little bit about the reaction of the social media companies. So you obviously spend a lot of time deposing folks, getting emails, communications. Have the social media companies, what's their response been to this? And are they, you know, I think our listeners would be interested to know, maybe it's too crude a way to put it, whose side are they on?
All right. Well, I think it's fair to say they are, don't bother us. Don't hurt us. We didn't sue them. But they did. We did subpoena them. And then negotiations came for what they were going to turn over. And I think some of us got into this litigation thinking they were all in cahoots, that the social media companies just wanted to work with the administration and they're all of like mind. And I think a lot of us had that prejudice about Silicon Valley and who you're likely to find there and what their attitudes to be. And maybe a little bit on certain subjects, but really what we see is resistance. They didn't want to do this because they had an economic model that more eyeballs are better. There was still this idea information wants to be free with the early internet with some of them. One of the guys, Nick Clegg, who used to be in the British government, actually told the FBI and the White House, well, you know, if you suppress this information, people aren't going to trust you and they're not going to trust us and you won't be able to get the type of actions you want because people won't trust you. So you can't just send these messages away. And so in the early days, there was a lot of resistance to it by the social media companies. They don't want to be involved in this because they're still afraid of 230 and all that. But one interesting thing is when we ask the government for all the emails and the records, and they're in the case, they turn over some, but they fight and they fight. But when the social media companies turned over the documents, lo and behold, there are all these people involved in harassing the social media companies the government didn't even tell us about. So the social media companies gave us information the government wouldn't. And I'd say for a long time, they tried to fight this for their own interests and to some extent, the interests of the people who use their platforms. But at some point in July, I think of 2020, they just capitulated. The pressure got so great. The Surgeon General, that's Murthy, who's in this, he sent a letter asking them for all this information. The White House was coming down on them. The FBI's calling all the time. So I think that they finally cracked is what happened. And that shows that it was government and not these companies. Because they did not want to do this to start with.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
It might be a little technical, but you made an important point, which is how some of our listeners are wondering, how could the federal government, the CDC under the Trump administration, or later the White House and the Biden administration, how could the federal government effectively pressure giant companies like Facebook or Twitter? What levers did they have against them? And you mentioned, for example, Section 230. Some of our listeners won't know what you mean when you say that.
So when the internet, there's two main ones. Some of it was just, it could be, and I'll give you some, all of these are regulated parties. They may want to buy a company. Let's say I'm Facebook and I want to buy another social media company. The government can make that very expensive through antitrust. They can say that you are violating antitrust. And sometimes you're not even violating antitrust, but they want to, I think Lena Khan at the FTC has said this. She wants to raise the costs of mergers, whether they'll be approved by the courts or not. And so that's one thing you can do. And that could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to a company. But Section 230, so that's the antitrust side. They can basically bother you when you have some purchase or something you want to do there. Or they could just attack you like they have now Apple and say you're violating antitrust laws in general. But the other thing they can do is Section 230 was put in at the beginning of the internet so that the internet wouldn't be squashed by libel claims or false claims, because as we know, the internet really isn't a newspaper. It doesn't have editors. The Facebook, they have algorithms and they have their user guide of what you're allowed to do and not do, but they don't have actual editors and they don't choose what people talk about on their platforms. So Section 230 was put in so that if I see something, you know, John Vecchione is a no goodnik who lies all the time, and that's on Facebook. I can't go sue Facebook for libel and say, wait a minute, that's not true. I don't lie all the time. And then get millions of dollars because they didn't check and they were reckless as to me, right? So 230 was put in and put in all these protections. And it's why these social media companies have been able to get so big, why there's such vast platforms of information, because they don't have to worry, unless they do something illegal, like I was talking about earlier, they don't have to worry about kind of civil suits against them. And what does the government do? The government can do a number of things. They don't even have to go to Congress and change the law. The Justice Department or one of the regulatory authorities can say, we don't think 230 is that broad. We think they can do this to you under 230. So at the margins, they can say, even without congressional influence or a new law being passed, they can say, we don't think 230 does that. We think it's like this. And they can lessen their protections, which is also worth millions. And Facebook and all these social media, we think of them as really powerful, but against the United States government, no one's really powerful because Facebook can't put you in jail and the feds can't.
Mm. How were, when based on the evidence that you found, how was the federal government actually using Section 230? So for example, were they outright threatening or was it a kind of implication, like you said, mob boss, shame if something happened to your Facebook company? What evidence have you uncovered?
So it was a go low, go high. What happened was the White House, Jen Psaki from the bully pulpit would say, you know, we're going to look very closely at Section 230. At the same time, somebody at the FBI or this guy, Rob Flaherty, who just, you know, unloaded on the social media companies anytime he saw anything he didn't like. And the FBI saying, look, we're very worried about Russian infiltration and you shouldn't be helping with it. So the White House would send out the message about 230. It's not as if the email said, oh, and you heard the White House today about 230. It didn't go that way. It went message here, macro message, and then the micro messages every day and through these portals. Take this down. We don't like this. Why are you doing this? And I have a funny story, which I always tell because I find it absolutely amazing. So the social media companies had said, you know, our algorithm, this isn't really against our policies. They can say that. And the government said, no, you've got to tighten this up. You can't have this vaccine disinformation that it doesn't, you know, one of the examples I always use is the FDA requires pharmaceutical companies to put all the known side effects on their drugs. And that's why you see the commercials and all at the end. Well, if people just photographed the side effects and put that on the internet, that could be vaccine misinformation because it wasn't giving you a whole story. And this thing that the FDA requires you to put on your drugs could be taken off social media at the White House's request. And then they put up a new algorithm to stop people. And part of the algorithm was if you posted too often about vaccines, they figured you were a misinformer. And also if you said anything bad about the vaccines, well, the Biden White House, the president's Twitter feed, I think, might've been Facebook. I've forgotten which one. He was posting about the vaccines. And then he was posting when CDC paused Johnson & Johnson. Do you remember when the CDC paused the Johnson & Johnson? Well, all of that was true information. And the White House tweeted out that Johnson & Johnson had been paused and it talked about that. Well, they were caught in the net and they were all downgraded and they were caught in their own misinformer net. So Rob Flaherty, the White House, gets on the phone. He starts emailing and he starts like just berating them. How could you take the president down? How can the president be a misinformer? This is outrageous. We're going to get you for this. And the social media, because you can't call the head of the social media at Facebook or Twitter, but they can. And so they got taken off the misinformer list really quick, where all my clients or anybody else who's a regular person for the same stuff would have been taken down.
There are some of our listeners who are probably thinking, all right, that's a pretty condemning evidence of pressure by the federal government on Facebook, on Twitter, on the social media companies. But what about the objection, which no doubt you've heard many times, that is, these are private companies. They could say no. The federal government didn't directly coerce them, didn't punish them. There was no prior restraint enforcing it off. They decided to do that, and they control what's on their platform. So it was their actions.
Well, first, on the Hunter Biden laptop, I think it was a very clever prior restraint. There is, in the law, fraud is also a type of coercion. And there, the FBI had the Hunter Biden laptop. It knew all about it. And because it was worried it was going to come out, we think, it told all these social media there's going to be a lot of this Russian misinformation. And so what it had done is it prior restrained it by seeding the ground that this was going to be some sort of Russian maneuver. And then when it happened, they didn't correct the record. So I think that is, under the law, real coercion of the type we're talking about, because falsehood is coercion in these cases. But the other thing is that the private entities are fighting. And under the law, if the private entity is shown to be fighting what the government's asking for and asking for, but then the pressure grows, as I think what the record's going to show is the statements from the White House became more inflammatory, and the anger expressed by the White House press secretary and everybody else became higher. I think any jury would find what the district court found was, yeah, this was not of their own accord. As a factual matter, as found on the record right now, he says it's more likely than not, it's by clear and convincing evidence, that these social media companies did not do this of their own accord for many of the reasons I'm telling you. They did it because the government scared them into doing it. And so that is not allowed. We always use the case Bantam Books, which was out of Rhode Island in the 60s. And there was a pressure to get pornography out of these bookstores, which was illegal speech. But what they had was they just had a sheriff go there and say, I don't like these books or these books, and you should get rid of all these authors without any finding that they're pornography. And they didn't do anything except have the police officer say, we're going to cause you some problems. There was no specific threat. And the publishers, not the bookstore, but the publishers were able to shut that down because that was coercion. It's not like the president called up the publishers. This is not the case where they're calling up the guy making the argument and saying, don't make that argument. During the Cold War, I think the Washington Post and New York Times would get calls from the White House and say, if you let this story go, our spies in Vietnam or in Laos or somewhere are going to get killed. You've got to sit on this for 5 or 6 days while we get them out. Then they'd wait 5 or 6 days. They'd let them out. And as long as they'd say, look, we don't want to get scooped on this. The White House said, yeah, that's not going to happen. And then they'd hold the thing for 5 days voluntarily. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about them saying to take down your speech, which isn't their speech, and you have no idea about it. It's not like the president called you and said, you know, you were a little harsh on the vaccines, and I think that's really not right, and here's why. So please, could you go a little easy, and then you either do or don't. It's not that situation.
What have you found in reaction to your litigation? Sometimes civil liberties make strange bedfellows, that it cuts across partisan lines or political lines. What have you found in the political and social reaction to your litigation?
Well, I you make a good point there. It has the whole. I have a stack of amicus briefs on both sides, and you know, many people who like the Texas and Florida laws don't like what the government did in Murthy and vice versa. And then you have a bunch of people who don't like any of it, and they've been against it all. But I think what you found is that there's been a big overlap. I'll give an example: is that RFK Jr., who I consider a man on the left, he joined the case after it had been appealed to the Supreme Court down below in Louisiana, and he was actually censored, like by name. The White House said, get that RFK Jr. guy off of the social media. Don't let him on there at all. And the social media said, why? He hasn't broken our rules. Get him off. And they got him off. They were actually that afraid of the White House anger to it. So I think it has made, and a lot of civil liberties, I told you the ACLU's helping the NRA. The fact is, and it can't be stressed enough, it doesn't matter whose ox is getting gored. If the government's allowed to do this, then nobody's speech is safe. in a Republican administration, it might be something, oh, we don't want anyone to know where the abortion providers are, so you can't put that on your website. We don't want anything out there. We don't want anyone saying that the election of 2020 was fair. You got to take down all that. It was a fair election stuff. And the social media companies, afraid of antitrust, afraid of 230, could do it. It doesn't matter what you're saying. Either government gets to censor in this way or it does not. But if it does, we're all going to be in the soup eventually.
What is your hope now, looking to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court decision? What is your hope for the Supreme Court decision?
I hope that they uphold the injunction. There is, as a separate matter, they don't. Gorsuch, for instance, doesn't like nationwide injunctions. They may narrow the injunction to just the plaintiffs who sued here, or maybe just the social media companies we got discovery on. We got discovery on five. That means we were able to find out things about them by asking them questions. Maybe just those social media companies and not all. I really hope that they affirm or do what the Fifth Circuit did, which is narrow a little bit and say you can do this or not that. But the main thing is that cannot happen is that they say, oh, yeah, this is fine. The government can scare the daylights out of social media companies using all regulatory power it possibly can, and that's okay. That cannot happen. And in Vulo, I think that the facts there are that it was done for bad reasons. There was no regulatory risk. It was a ruse, basically, and they can't debank you because they have levers over something else and to shut you up. So I hope that we win both those cases.
Your organization, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, if some of our listeners want to know more about it, where can they go?
nclalegal.org.
John Vecchione, thanks very much for joining us for this really fascinating and important conversation. Thanks again for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.